Welcome to Threads of Healing, conversations with the wayward and the wise. This is your host, Dr. Ila Manga, coming to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Threads of Healing is the space for exploring what healing could mean by having deep conversations with wisdom keepers, doctors, artists, storytellers, fact finders, and visionaries. We bring awareness to the voices who have answered their call to heal and to discover a new way of living, breathing, and being in the world, and will inspire you to do the same. Today, I'm incredibly honored and privileged to welcome a guest that I hold in deep reverence. She's a contemporary sage and a powerful healer, a holder of indigenous and sacred knowledge systems. She's a scholar and a scientist whose studies span broadly across the disciplines of medicine, engineering, education, technology, and socioeconomic development and cosmology, but whose personal practice has taken her deep into the mystical traditions of African indigenous wisdom, teachings of the mysteries of ancient Egypt and Chinese medicine. She's the chairperson of the Credo Mutua Foundation and is part of the Alliance of the Protection of Sacred Sites. Her wisdom is deeply embodied and expressed through her practice of Wushu. I believe the world needs to deeply listen to the wisdom that comes through her. So today, I'm very proud and privileged to introduce to you Rutendo Ngara. Rutendo, welcome to Threads of Healing.
Thank you so much, Ila. Thank you so much for this invitation.
Well, you know, I was going through your bio and it occurred to me that your wisdom, your inherent knowing of who you are, was probably something that was with you very early on in life. That must have been a challenge for you growing up.
Perhaps I can take it right down to when I was born. So my father is Zimbabwean, from Zimbabwe, and he met my mother in Lesotho, and they got married in Lesotho, and then he took her through apartheid South Africa, through the warring Zimbabwe, to introduce him to his relatives in Zimbabwe. my mom saw a chameleon and went into labor. She'd never seen an animal that changes color and moves so slowly. Yeah. So they rushed her to the local clinic hospital, but it was literally just a two-roomed clinic. And there, the nurses would not allow her to enter because according to the cosmology or the culture from Zimbabwe, a child that's born at midday, which is when I was trying to be born, is a curse. And, you know, normal children, they said, are born either at dusk or at dawn. And so she was literally not allowed to enter into the clinic, you know, to give birth to me. Interesting enough, she had to go back home to the village, and she returned the next day, once again going into labor at midday, you know, around the midday hour. And my aunt, my dad's sister, had to birth me at completely not knowing what to do, you know, on the kind of the steps of the clinic at exactly 12 o'clock, which was the time of the curse. And so I have kind of carried that through my life. You know, people would tell my mom to throw me into the deepest river, you know, because they felt that there was something about me that was unusual, that did not fit into the paradigm, you know, as it was known. And so I've carried seeing things and not knowing how to make sense of it because the people around me did not know how to make sense of it. And so that labeled me mad, you know, at some point. But through particular journeys of initiations, I've managed to bring myself back towards myself and start to understand kind of the totality of what it is that I was being called for.
But before you understood what was happening, did you identify with this idea that there was something wrong with you, that this was a curse? Was that something you
you related to?
Absolutely, absolutely. As I said, because certainly the society that I lived in, certainly coming back from the even, for instance, the Christian background that I came from, and also the traditional background that I came for, I didn't fit into the box. You know, I didn't fit into any of the boxes, and so for me, it meant that there was something wrong with me. You know, and I couldn't make sense of it, because nobody could make sense of me. And so then I bought into the idea that there was something wrong. I ended up in psychiatric care as well. And, you know, after 5 years of psychiatric care, the psychiatrist actually came to me and said, look, Rotendo, you've actually just been called to be a healer. You know, I have spent 5 years pumping you with all sorts of medicines, which I was not meant to do. I've destroyed you. Go and find yourself. So I did buy into it, but I'm grateful for that, because it's helped me to understand life better, and it's also helped me to understand other people's journeys better, because many people who come into my purview suffer from similar, you know, issues. And so I've had the opportunity to, you know, to draw from my own experience in serving as a mirror, not necessarily seeing them through me, but just as a mirror that they can see themselves. And so I'm grateful for the experience that I had.
Yeah, you know, it's when we kind of step back and look at our lives from a different perspective and reflect on the role of that suffering, and we can appreciate the gift of that. And in the moment, it's not always easy to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has definitely not been easy. And I think I've probably spent about 30 years trying to find myself, you know. And it's only in recent times that I've been able to be truly appreciative of the experience.
What was the shift for you?
So I wouldn't put the shift as a once-off event. I'd put it as a process, and it has been a process of self-discovery and a process of listening. And so over a period of about 10 years, I found myself being called, strangely enough, to various sacred sites. And it was quite frustrating for my boss at the time. I'd be sitting in the office working, and suddenly I'd have this urge to drive to the Kalahari, you know, or this urge to drive to Zimbabwe, or this urge to drive to Limpopo and go and talk to Baobab Tree and then drive back, you know. So it would be kind of this 14-hour drive because something was calling me, you know. And it happened over about 10 years where I found myself being called in this particular way, not quite understanding what was happening, which also fed into my idea that, okay, there's something seriously wrong with me. I must be completely mad. But it's only kind of in recent times that I've become to understand, especially as the call for, you mentioned that I'm part of the Alliance for Sacred Sites of the Earth, Gaia, you know, as, you know, the call for sacred sites to be taken into far more into the mainstream and, you know, protected, that I've started understanding what the call was, and started understanding how nature speaks and how we are called by the speaking of nature, and how this is the indigenous way that healing takes part.
Do you believe that our reconnection with sacred sites is important, especially where we find ourselves now?
Absolutely. I'll give a story. About 4 years ago, I happened to go to Zimbabwe with a friend. She was from the Netherlands, and she just wanted to experience Zimbabwe. So we traveled through the country for 14 days, you know, going to several sacred sites in Zimbabwe. But on our way there, driving from South Africa, we got to the Zimbabwe border, and there was a fire. There was smoke, you know, billowing, and the country was in kind of a national lockdown because there was a protest. Now, Zimbabweans are very, it takes a lot for Zimbabweans to go into protest, you know, especially natural protests.
Yes.
So there we were, not able to cross the border because, you know, the border was shut down because there was this natural protest. Thankfully, my companion and I are quite had of the same mind, so we just found a different way of getting into Zimbabwe. We went via Botswana. And we found ourselves at some point in the north of the country, in a very remote village with the people that are very remote and almost seen as backward, because they're you know, considered even by the contemporary Zimbabwean people as being quite primitive. And these are the Tonga people who are custodians of the Zambezi River, which actual name is Kasamambezi, which means only they who know are able to cross. And or they who know the ways of the river are able to cross. And so we found ourselves with an elder from the Tonga people. And so I said to him, you know, why is the country in turmoil at the moment? Why is it a national protest? And he said, it's because the elephants no longer walk past and give us their messages, and because the sacred sites have been fenced and we can no longer do our ceremonies. And it seemed so out there, so esoteric, how can you, equate socioeconomic decline, to elephants walking past and giving messages, or being able to do, ceremonies at the sacred sites. But if we understand African cosmology, we understand, or indigenous cosmology, that everything is connected, everything is interconnected, interrelated, and interdependent. And you cannot separate the political from the spiritual. Mm-hmm. You cannot separate the emotional from the mental. You cannot separate the physical, from the everlasting. And so it's only with time that one would be able to unpack those few words that he said into understanding what, indigenous cosmology is all about, And we know that elephants are keepers of memory, So when, he spoke about the elephants walking past, we know they walk silently and they're matriarchal, So there's something in that, that he was saying, and which is very relevant now, because if we've known in Botswana, we're having elephants just spontaneously dying.
Yes.
And what is that saying about the time that we're in? When the keepers of memory, the matriarchs, are literally just keeling over and dying, We also know that our baobabs are spontaneously imploding. And, they have existed for thousands of years, and what is it about this time that is causing them to spontaneously implode? And I think if we go into indigenous wisdom, we may start to have understanding of A, what's happening, but B, how it is that we've probably strayed away from the way of nater or nature in our dealings with life as humans.
You know, you're speaking to two principles of healing that I've been thinking about a lot. And the first is that healing is relational. That we are relational beings. We are in relation to aspects of ourselves. We are in relation to each other. We are in deep relation to nature and to our history.
Absolutely.
And the second is that healing is the relationship between remembering and imagining. Mm-hmm. And I think your story really brings that to light and to the fore. And I think it's so beautiful that this wisdom is held in these indigenous knowledge systems, and our invitation is to return to them, to figure out what it means for us now. Mm. You know, the first time I met you, I think you were describing a beautiful concept of Ntu, and it really, really touched me, and it stayed with me. Can you tell us a little bit about the concept of Ntu, Ubuntu?
Absolutely. But before I go that, let me go back into healing as memory or remembering. And in our indigenous paradigm, remember has got different attributes to it. It is to remember as in going back into the recesses of memory. But it is also remember as in bringing the parts that have been fragmented together. So remembering, as well as remembering, reminding us all that we're part of the same member. We're members of the same whole. And so this is what, when we speak about Ntu, we're speaking about. So Ubuntu has become quite a catchphrase. And, we have everything from software programs to, marketing programs, that are named after Ubuntu. And it's often said to be, I am because we are. And the contemporary understanding is quite a humanized understanding. It's that I am because you as Ila are. You know, my humanity is your humanity. And it's often termed as humanity. But when we start to unpack actually what Ubuntu is, we realize it is a lot more than just a relation between one human to the other or one grouping of humans to another grouping. And so first let me go back into, we spoke about nature. And in indigenous African cosmology, the all-pervasive force that exists, everything, all that is called Neter. And if you take out the vowels in that, it's N-T-R. And if we place other vowels into that, we see nature. You know, so the word for the all-pervasive, all-existing, everything, you know, is Neter, which is actually nature. It has found itself through Latin as natura into nature as we know it. And this nature has an immanent and immanent force that flows through it, and this immanent and immanent force is Ntu. Mm-hmm. And Ntu persists, subsists in everything. If amongst the Venda, they might call it Mupo. It just exists in everything.
And is it the same as chi? Is it the same as prana?
It has the same similar quality, you know, because it just exists in everything. Amongst the Bushmen here, they'll call it Ngum, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it just persists and subsists in everything. And then it manifests into four main archetypes. The first is Muntu, mm-hmm. with the plural of Bantu. And Muntu is a reasoned being, an intelligent being. Mm-hmm. And so this is human beings who are this aspect of how Ntu manifests itself. And they have the principle of reason and rationality and intelligence. And their plural is Bantu. So according to Bantu cosmology, all humans are actually Bantu, you know, because they exist as this manifestation of Ntu. And then the next is what we call Kintu or Bintu in the plural. And Kintu are unreasoned beings or those that are acted upon by the reasoned being Muntu in order to come into manifestation. And we may speak about plants, we may speak about animals, we may speak about minerals, we may speak about any being that does not necessarily have what we as humans may consider to be the intelligence, the reasoned intelligence. What is very interesting about Kintu is that it does not include trees, because trees sit under the category of Muntu.
Wow.
As beings, as human beings, because trees are the ones that carry from this realm into the realms of the ancestors. And as we know, in indigenous cosmology, there is no difference between those who have walked before, those who exist now, and those who are to come. So our ancestors, our living beings, and our descendants are all part of the same continuum. And trees are the medium through which these are carried.
Wow, that's so incredible.
Yeah. And then the third principle is Hantu. And Hantu denotes time, but it also denotes space. So it is the where and the when. And if we go into Limpopo here in South Africa, you'll often find a place called Ha something or Ha something, you know, or even in KZN, Kwa, you know, which is denoting this principle of Ha, which is a time-space continuum. And if I say that, people may think quantum physics. So here is a principle that has existed for millennia in African cosmology that actually speaks to what quantum physics has recently discovered, that time and space are collapsed into a single continuum. And so it is this where and when that is inherent in Hantu. And then the fourth aspect of Ntu is what we call Kuntu, which is a modality. So, or it's a modal force that we don't necessarily see or touch, but we sense, such as fear or beauty, or, you know, any, you know, emotion that
expression
mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't necessarily have a manifestation in a physical being. And so these four, Muntu, Kintu, Hantu, and Kuntu, are all aspects of Ntu. So now going back to when you spoke about relation, when we speak about healing must be an alignment between these four, between time and space, you know, between things or unreasoned things, between human beings, and between the expressions that they have. And when we speak about healing, we are relating in these three aspects in an interconnected, interdependent, and interrelated manner.
So you know that I'm really passionate about breathing, conscious breathing and breath work and its role in healing. How is breath referred to in African cosmology and in the disciplines that you study, in the wisdom of ancient Egypt, in all the aspects of healing that you work with?
Yeah, so breath can be moya here in Southern Africa, even in Zimbabwe. And so moya is breath, but it's also like if we go into Zimbabwe, it's moya, which is also the spirit. So breath is spirit, and it is the way we connect with Ntu. It's the breath is the modality through which Ntu manifests through us, as especially as reasoned beings. But even animals, they have spirit, you know, that expresses itself through breath. Mm-hmm. So this cyclical experience of the expansion and contraction of the lungs, where we're taking in one aspect of whether it is the oxygen, which has a feminine attribute to it, and expelling, you know, carbon dioxide, which has a masculine aspect to it, you know, then starts to, you know, to show us how it is that spirit exists within us, you know, through moya or mueya, exists through us through breath. And so it is the way, the transportation of breath. And of course, when we spoke about trees, they do this through the process of photosynthesis, you know, where they're transforming light into sugar. And so that is the breath, you know, that they have, and it's the spirit through which the ancestors are carried into the present, making space for the descendants who are yet to come.
Something else that really struck me about the first time I heard you speak was this idea of rivers as almost meridians, and this kind of concept of as above, so below. And every aspect of nature is reflected within our beings. Can you tell us more about the rivers of Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a subject I absolutely love, because Africa has four or five great rivers. It has the longest river in the world, which is the Nile, which is more than 6,000 kilometers long. It has the deepest river and the most powerful river in the world, which is the Congo River. It also has the most obscure river in the world, which is the Niger River. The Niger River, unlike most rivers, we know they'll go from a place of higher altitude and make their way towards the ocean. The Niger River follows an interesting and obscure course. It arises about 250 kilometers from the ocean, and instead of moving down the 250 kilometers to the ocean, it moves inwards into the Sahara Desert, past Timbuktu, making a weird turn right through the Niger Delta, eventually traveling 4,000 kilometers instead of 250 kilometers that it could have traveled to the ocean.
Wow. No. I mean, just in that itself, there's so much symbolism and
absolutely,
meaning, right?
Absolutely, which is the indigenous way. It won't take the shortest route. It will take the most, won't even take the most, what may be seen as the most efficient route, because the efficient route would have been for the river to start a rise and go that 250 kilometers to the ocean. But instead, it takes this obscure route, and what arises from that is the Niger Delta. And the Niger Delta has one of the largest biodiversities on the continent. And, you know, it's also where it's very rich in oil, you know, and all manners of things. You know, all of this because the river has taken an obscure route. Into finally, you know, emptying into the river. And this is what indigenous knowledge teaches us. You know, this is the way of indigenous knowledge. It may seem obscure, like, you know, the elder telling us that, no, there's a natural protest because the elephants are not walking past anymore. But that's the obscurity of ancient wisdom, you know, that we need to truly understand its nature in order to understand.
And it's not obvious.
It's not obvious. It's not obvious. It requires you to get into a particular way of being, into a particular paradigm, in order to experience and experience what the true meaning is. And we can't rationalize it, you know. And I think a lot of maybe our difficulties have been trying to rationalize indigenous wisdom, and it can't be rationalized, you know. Indigenous wisdom will tell you that there's a dynamic still point, that you can be simultaneously still and moving at the same time. that we can't rationalize with our brain, but we can experience and experience if we go into the ceremony of what Indigenous knowledge is feeding us. Then the fourth river is the Kasemambezi that I spoke about, you know, or the Zambezi River, which flows through the largest curtain of water in the world, which is Musiwatunya, the smoke that thunders, that is more popularly known as Victoria Falls. And these rivers have many interesting attributes to them. The Nile River lies on what they call the Nile Meridian. It's roughly 31 degrees longitude to the east. And this Nile Meridian is what is been called by the ancient ones of Kemet as the first line, the line of first time, the golden meridian. It's called Zeb Tepe. And it is said that this is the golden meridian because if you go under, you'll find gold along this particular meridian. But it also mimics, as you said, as above the galaxy, mm-hmm. in the Milky Way, rather. Yeah. You know, so it's the rivers below, the river that is apparent in the rivers above. And it is said that this is civilization as we know it has moved along this Nile Meridian. Many people will look to ancient Egypt and think, oh, that's where a lot of modern civilization came from. But Credo Mutwa, one of our great Sanusis, tells us that actually the knowledge went up the Nile Meridian from here where we are in the south, here in South Africa. And we only have to go to Mpumalanga to start seeing what it is that he meant. In Mpumalanga, we have Inzalayolanga. Inzalayolanga is a sacred site, which is a stone calendar, which predates Stonehenge by many thousands of years. And then we have also, and it is the oldest solar calendar known to humanity.
I've been there, actually. The energy is just absolutely, I mean, it's indescribable.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it predates Naptaplea, which is in Egypt. So evidently there's knowledge that was held here that moved up, you know, going up the Nile Meridian until it reached there, finally culminating in the Great Pyramid of Giza, which when you look at the alignments between where we are on the planet and, you know, stellar bodies such as Sirius or the Orion, they're all in communion, you know, and in communication and in alignment with these. So that's the oldest solar calendar in the world. If we go not too far from that in the mountains of Swaziland, we have the Lebombo Mountains, where the oldest lunar calendar in the world has been discovered, you know, which is notches made in the bone of a fibula of a baboon. And it is said that it is young women who started realizing that their monthly cycles were aligned with the cycles of the moon.
Yes.
And then they started tracking that and they created this lunar calendar. So the oldest lunar calendar in the world, you know, and the oldest solar calendar in the world are found here in the south. But not only that, in that same area, we have recently had the Makonjwa Mountains or the Barberton Greenbelt declared as a UNESCO heritage site because it contains the oldest DNA of the planet, you know, and so there's something about this particular part of the world, which then is all on the what they call the Nile Meridian, you know, which then moved up, as Baba Credo said, along this Zeb Tepe Nile Meridian, and erupting as the Nile does either at the Great Lakes or in the highlands of Ethiopia, manifesting as a river that eventually found itself into the desert, allowing civilization to happen in a place that civilization couldn't happen if there's no water in the desert. So the Nile River has carried so much, you know, that of the knowledge that we know, because if we look into the Greeks, so many of the Romans learned in Egypt, you know, before they went out and took the knowledge that we know as modern medicine, as modern astronomy, as modern mathematics, you know, came from this particular Nile Meridian. So that's one of my favorite rivers, the longest river in the world. But then we have the deepest river in the world, the Congo River. Mm-hmm. And it's also the most powerful river in the world, and it runs through the Congo Basin, you know, and the Congo Jungle, which is the second largest, rainforest next to the Amazon. But what is really where it arises in the Great Rift, Valley of East Africa. And it carries with it, obviously, everything. That's a very highly volcanic area of the continent. And but it travels through a deeply wounded part of Africa. If we look at the war, the Congo War, which is one of the highest numbers of deaths, you know, in the Congo War, in a place which has, Congo is actually the country with the highest water sources in the continent, and yet most of those water sources are not potable.
Potable.
Yeah, potable. Because of the destructions of war, and so we have the most water-rich country in the world being one of the most water-scarce countries in the world. And we all know that there's, you know, great war of resources that have taken place in that country. It's got high biodiversity, but such great atrocities that have taken mm-hmm. place there. And we start to see that it was born, the Congo River was born from a place of wounding, the wound of the continent, the Rift Valley, where we have a lot of tectonic activity, volcanic activity, earthquake activity. So we start understanding why in later time there would be so much conflict in that particular area where this river flows through. So we can already start to understand the medicine of the river through its source, and the medicine in terms of what we see in terms of the conflict that is in that part of the world. So the rivers teach us in so many different ways. The Zambezi River meanders through about 6 to 9 countries, and it doesn't take, you know, a straight route like the Niger River. And everywhere it forms, it's forming rituals. You know, it is said that it forms rituals, you know, because it is drawing sources from the one end, depositing in another, until it finally goes through through Lake Kariba and the Kaburabasa Basin before eventually going through to the Indian Ocean. And in its movement, it's moving with ritual. And the ritual that it moves with is the ritual that is determined by the spirit of that river, which they call the Nyami Nyami. It is the river serpent. And this river serpent carries the cosmology of the river, which is taken care of by the custodian I spoke about earlier mm-hmm. of the Tonga people, you know, who carry the wisdom through this river. So the river itself is a living, breathing entity. It's a living, breathing being which, if I can also say, actually the original source is in Botswana, in a place that they call Makgadi Khadi. And Makgadi Khadi is a place, it's in the desert. So that's the original source of the Zambezi River before it moved to its source in Zambia. And when we look at how Makgadi Khadi has been named, Khadi may be referred to the feminine, to an aunt, but it's also a place of great dryings. So in the naming of our indigenous people, when they named that place Makgadi Khadi, they not only knew that there was a river that had, that there was a source of water that had established from there, but they also knew that it was going to dry, you know, with time. But they also knew that what it carried was the feminine, which is what rivers carry in indigenous African cosmology, is they carry the feminine principle. And not only just the feminine principle, but the young feminine principle, the premenstrual or menstrual feminine principle. And so when we see our rivers polluted, we understand gender-based violence, you know, because that when we see the way the rivers are struggling, you know, when we see the way they are blocked, we start understanding why it is that we have such violence against, you know, young females in the world today. So
what you're saying is the societal ills that we're seeing is not disconnected from how we're relating to nature.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. So what does this mean in terms of our responsibility for healing?
So it means, firstly, moving away from this very human-centered idea of healing. So if we are to start looking at, for instance, something like gender-based violence, then we need to look at how we treat our rivers. You know, so it requires us to get into an environmental conservational space as well, in order to understand, because the rivers are mirroring what's happening in society. Society is mirroring what's happening in the rivers when we speak about what's happening with the young feminine. So it, that takes us back into Hantu, into Kuntu, into Bintu, into Muntu. That everything has Ntu cycling through it. You know, all aspects of Nature or nature has Ntu cycling through it. Therefore, as humans seeking healing, we need to be healing that which is our brother and our sister, all our relations, which is time. We need to be healing time. We need to be healing locality. We need to be healing space. We need to be healing things. And we need to be healing each other as humans, all in alignment with Ntu.
What I really love about African indigenous wisdom is that it is so embodied. And so if we are going to have this conversation in relation to a traumatized community, for example, how do we engage with ourselves and each other in a way that allows the wisdom to rise from within us in a very embodied way? And so I love the idea of reconnecting with ritual, with just being in nature that we are a part of, because that is the environment that supports our awareness of us as part of something greater.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you mentioned an important word, which is embodiment, you know, or embodied. And perhaps one thing about, you know, African indigenous knowledge is everything exists in the body, because the body is seen as the gateway. It's seen as the ship. It's seen as the temple, for lack of a better word, of spirit and of Ntu. And so, for instance, if we were to connect with our ancestors, you know, we find that we're able to embody our ancestors within our actual bodies. Often it's been thought that Africans worship ancestors. Yes. And this has brought a consternation between kind of Abrahamic religions, you know, such as Christianity, and indigenous knowledge, where it is seen that they do not see God, you know, Africans do not see God as, especially as the monotheistic God, but worship ancestors instead. And this could not be further from the truth. You know, Africans acknowledge that there is an all-pervasive, you know, being that we've called Nature, if we want to call it God or whatever we can, but that it manifests in multiple ways. And it manifests in the continuum of time from the ancestors to the present into the future, into the descendants, those who are to come. And we who are walking, living on this planet at this particular time are the mediums through which the past and the future are embodied. And so we can embody the ancestors and the descendants, you know, through us at this time. We all, I think genetics will tell us that we all come from a particular, you know, lineage, you know, and we have particular traits that we will exhibit because of the lineage or the blood, you know, that's expressed through us. By the same way, in African cosmology, so do our ancestors at multiple levels. And how they express ourselves, you know, interestingly enough, is we often find when somebody has a calling to become a traditional healer that they'll say that your ancestors are sitting on your shoulders or they're sitting in your body. And you often find when one is going through what they call an initiation calling, a Twasa illness, before they become initiated into their calling, they'll often have certain physical ailments, which when you take them to a normal doctor, you know, a Western doctor, it won't render it. Even if they have stroke-like, you know, symptoms, you know, it won't, it's unhealable, you know. And normally it's ritual that is required. And this ritual is in determining who or what is sitting, is embodying itself, you know, within the body, and what of the ancestors is embodying itself, you know, through this particular body, you know, that it's trying to send messages through, because the body carries the messages from the ancestors. And as much as that elder said, the elephants are carrying, you know, the messages. So, for instance, we'll find that our cardinal ancestors, you know, be it our, you know, our maternal grandfather, our maternal grandmother, our paternal grandmother, our paternal grandfather, tend to sit on our ball and socket joints in the body.
Now, this is something that is not traditionally known, but it came as an insight to you, recently, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, as I was working with the ancestors and, you know, working with how do we experience, so firstly, if I go into back into Ubuntu, you know, if we look at Ubuntu, it's got those four manifestations of Muntu, Kuntu, Kintu, and Hantu, and then Ubuntu is the apex, and we see a pyramid, you know, that manifests there.
Yeah.
By the same token, within ourselves, if we look at our ancestry, we have got our paternal, you know, our paternal grandfather, our paternal grandmother, our maternal grandfather, our maternal grandmother, and we are at the center. We form another pyramid, you know. And, you know, so then we started understanding why our ancestors built pyramids, you know, because, you know, because they demonstrate or they illustrate many, many aspects of our cosmology and our way of being. And so by the same token, we know we've got four ball and socket joints on our body. You know, we've got, you know, our left shoulder, our right shoulder, and our two hips. And in the same way, because we've got these four cardinal ancestors, they sit on either one of those ball and socket joints. And which is why you'll tend to find that people who are in having a calling tend to start having problems in the joints, you know, either not being able to walk or, you know, things like that. It's because maybe one of those ancestors is trapped, is unhealthy, is unwell, or even if they're not trapped, they're trying to get a message through, but the body is not in that frequency that is able to accept it. And so this is where ritual comes in. This is where cleansings come in. This is where alignments come in as part of the indigenous paradigm in order to find alignment between self and these four cardinal points, which then forms the pyramid. And between the ancestors that have come before, who we are now in the present, and those who are coming to the future. And yeah, everything in ritual.
That's incredible, Rutendo. Let's talk a little bit more about embodiment. Mm. This is what also really fascinates me about you, is that you have found a way to really embody the wisdom and express it through your relationship with martial arts. Can you tell us about Wushu? You are a silver medalist in the World Champions of Wushu, am I right?
That's correct.
I mean, tell us about that. Tell us about your practice.
Wow. Yes. So, you know, I went to a boys' school for my A-levels, you know, my final year of high school. Final 2 years of high school, and I was beaten up a lot. And then from there, I decided I was going to study engineering, and this was way back in 94, and I was one of six females in a class of 100. And I found myself being beaten up, not necessarily physically like I was, you know, at the boys' school where I did my A-levels. And the reason I had to do my A-levels at a boys' school was because I wanted to study physics. And the girls' school that I was at did not believe girls could do physics. So, you know, I had to go to a boys' school to study it. And so when I arrived at university, you know, knowing that I was going into a very male-dominated sphere, having the trauma, so to speak, of, you know, of what I'd experienced at high school, I immediately saw, you know, that there was a kung fu club at school, you know, at university, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to learn how to beat up boys, you know, and so I joined the kung fu, you know, school, and it was wonderful. I got to express myself and my anger and all of that. But with time, I realized that no, this is not what the point of martial arts is. It's not about me, you know, being violent and learning to be violent. And it took me many years to actually come into understanding what does wushu, which is the actual term for Chinese martial arts, mean. And maybe I can just break it down what the word wushu is. And often people speak about kung fu. Mm-hmm. And kung fu is a term that Bruce Lee took to the West when he brought, you know, this martial art to the West. And kung fu is actually mastery through limitations of any discipline. So you can be a kung fu of medicine, you can be a kung fu of street cleaning, you can be a kung fu master of, you know, of baking, you know.
So it's a mastery of something.
It's a mastery, and it's a mastery that comes through hard work, you know, through hard work and limitations. You know, that's what kung fu is. But martial arts is also hard work, you know. And the actual term, as I've said, is wushu. And wushu is broken up into two, you know, parts. There's wu and there's shu. Wu, if you go into the characters, is broken up into two characters. There's ji and there's he, where ji means to stop and he is an ancient weapon of war. Now, shu, it actually means a discipline or a practice. So when you break that down, even though we can loosely say wushu is Chinese martial arts, what it actually means is the art of stopping war. And so we learn, you know, of the ways of the warrior, because we need to understand the ways of the warrior in order to learn to stop the war. And so this is why I have taken this up as a practice over how many years now, 27 years that I've taken it up. And essentially, in what they call the externals, which is what you see Jackie Chan and Jet Li doing in the movies, but more so in recent times, Tai Chi, which is, you know, a lot softer and slow, and you usually see old people in the parks doing it, which is actually an incredibly potent martial art, simply because you're learning to tap into softness, you're learning to tap into slowness, you're learning to tap into metabolism, you know, requires you, you know, to, you know, that's why it's usually done by older people, because they have learned perseverance, they have learned endurance, you know, and they're able to take part in those very slow, painful movements in that slow manner, you know, because they've learned the art of endurance. And Tai Chi also incorporates a lot of principles from Qigong, the cultivation of Qi, the life force, you know, as part of the principle. But it has got a very strong martial aspect to it as well. As I said, Tai Chi is actually a very potent martial art, even though it just looks so beautiful. Its potency lies in its softness. Its potency lies in its slowness, you know, which is a bit of a contradiction when we think of force as power, you know, but actually... And when I try and equate the more external side to the more internal side, I see the external side as being more masculine, the internal, the Tai Chi, as being more feminine, which then speaks once again to the rivers. You know, Tai Chi is a very watery, you know, aspect, whereas the external is more fiery. And so in the Chinese martial arts and the Chinese cosmology, in as much as the African cosmology, we're always working with the elements. You know, we're always working with how do we balance out the elements of water against or with the elements of fire, earth, and air as well.
So, Rutendo, if we look at what's happening in the world right now, if we look at what's happening in our country, if we look at what's happening in Zimbabwe, it feels like everything is falling apart. And it really struck me when I heard a poet, David White, say something on his recent visit to South Africa. And he said that he feels that when he's here, that this is the laboratory for the world. Do you feel that what's happening right now is a chaotic natural process of death, of breaking down? Or do you feel that this is part of us moving away? Do you think that it's part of the process, or do you believe that it's moving away from a process of healing?
Both and. Mm. So just in terms of this being a laboratory for the world, if we go to a sacred site in Botswana, Tsodilo Hills, which is somewhere in the northwest of Botswana, and it is the only real outcrop, you know, the higher ground in Botswana. Otherwise, everything else is completely flat. And it's one of the highest concentrations of Bushman paintings in the world, of Khoisan paintings in the world, including paintings of whales and penguins, you know, right there in Botswana, which is very interesting into how the First Nations ancestors, you know, were there. What is very, very interesting in that site is that the rock, which is volcanic rock, has naturally created a relief of the map of Africa. So there's this, and it's identically the map of Africa, which is a relief in the rock, the natural rock. And underneath that map of Africa is a cave. And this seems to be nature's way of giving some signal as to the importance of this particular place in the southern tip of the African continent, you know, and its purpose in the continent at large, but also in the world as a whole. And so that's just to say, what is that laboratory, you know, that you're speaking to. So back to the both and. In Kemetic cosmology or ancient Egyptian cosmology, we know that, and in other cosmologies as well, we know that different archetypal energies govern different moon cycles. And the moon cycle that we're currently in began on the 20th of July, and it will end around the 19th of August. And this particular moon cycle in the Osirian tradition is governed by a deity called Sekhet. Now, in other cosmologies, Sekhet is Kali and is Bina, you know, in the Kabbalistic, and, you know, is Nomkhoyi here in the south, which is the principle of the duality of creation and destruction at the same time. So both and what we know from nature is that in order for a seed to germinate, it has to die as a seed in order for it to germinate into the plant and eventually the tree that it becomes. So we're in this dynamic still point place where creation and destruction is taking place simultaneously. Where we as humans have had such a heavy hand in moving away from custodianship of nature into control of nature, where we have moved away from dominion into domination. And many of our practices and, you know, that which we have brought into the world, especially for the purposes of capital, you know, has had a destructive, you know, influence on the world. And we've spoken about the Congo River as, you know, the Congo is the most water-rich country in the world and yet the most water-scarce country in the world because of war around resources. So nature is responding, not fighting, but it's responding to firstly telling us, hey, you need to stop, you need to reconsider. Our basic stepping in Tai Chi requires you to move forward, lean back, and then move forward again. And so it's very slow because you keep leaning back in order to go forward. And nature is trying to get us back into that leaning back, you know, assessing in order to move forward. And in African cosmology, amongst the Akan in Ghana, this is what they call the principle of Sankofa. You know, where Sankofa tells you, look back into the past, you know, learn from it, bring it into the present in order to create a different future. And this principle of Sankofa, it is symbolized by a bird looking back with an egg, looking back towards its back. And it just seems like a symbol that they paint on walls and put on drums. But when we go into nature, we realize that Sankofa exists in everything. Sankofa exists in the homeostatic system of the body as a feedback, you know, mechanism. Sankofa exists in sugar regulation. Sankofa exists in psychology. Sankofa exists in the market, in sales. Sankofa exists in engineering. Sankofa exists in the predator-prey cycle in nature. And Sankofa exists in the environment. And when we see the expansion of natural disasters that we have today, you know, we know that there's something that's happened from the past or the way we are in the present, and we need to look back in the past in order to see what it is that we need to do now in order to create a greater future. So nature is responding in a feedback loop, you know, and whether it is responding in feedback in the economy, which is crashing, you know, and going into recession, whether it is feedbacking in terms of our education system, which it's not functioning the way it used to, our health system because of the pandemic, which is, you know, has increased, you know, which is keeping us all, you know, abuzz, not knowing quite where to go. Whatever it is, nature is responding, not reacting, but responding to how it is that we as humans have placed a heavy hand. But more than that, nature is actually just responding to the natural cycles of time, you know, because it always has the cycles of birth and rebirth, and things need to be destroyed in order for creation to happen again. And so this is the time we find ourselves in right now in this particular month. We are, as I say, in the cycle of Kali, of Sekhet, of Bina, you know, when we need to be really looking into how do we live in cycles in healing, because we've moved away from cyclical living. So women's menstrual cycles are no longer aligned directly to the moon cycles as they were when the young ladies, you know, created the calendar, the lunar calendar on the fibula of a baboon. Which, why a baboon? Because in ancient cosmology, baboons are holders of wisdom. You know, so they would have used the baboon fibula in order to use that. So we're trying to be taken back into being aligned with the cycles, you know, the cycles of nature, which we've become so out of tune with. And because we're out of tune with, we've actually accelerated what would have been the natural cycle of destruction that nature was bringing upon us.
So if us as Bantu are to reconnect with the wisdom of nature and to really listen to the voices of those who have come before us, how would you summarize what it is that we need to move forward remembering, committing to?
I'd firstly use that word remember, you know, so go back into memory and see what has been done before, not to copy it or to bring it into this day and age, but to see what it is that needs to be transformed, because healing is as much restoration as it is transformation. It is the movement from one form to the other, whether it is the movement from dis-ease to wellness. And so we can learn many clues from what has been done before, the ways that our ancestors have taught us, and which a lot of it has been written, maybe not in the books that we understand, but has been written in our songs, you know, has been written in our dances, has been written in the shapes of our masks, the designs on the clay pots, has been written, if you look at the Ndebele hut, you know, has been written in the Ndebele hut, you know, but has also been written on the walls of the caves by our First Nations peoples. And there's a lot of uncoding and decoding that we need to do in order to understand. And one such as Ubaba Kredumutwa, you know, was one who was trying to help us, you know, to uncode and decode for this time that we're in terms of the many warnings he issued, you know, about the time that we're in, and that we're actually, which he died a day before we went into lockdown, you know.
I found that incredibly significant.
Yeah, absolutely significant. So, yeah, remember as in go back into memory, remember as come back into community, and remember as in bring back the fragments which have been cast to the ends of the earth.
Thank you for listening to Threads of Healing, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ila Manga. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do so on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And feel free to leave a review and tell us what you think. If you have found this podcast inspiring and useful, and you know someone who would too, please feel free to pass this along.